And Senator Frank, you had a report out of, a report for Senator Coghill's bill, an act approving the issuance of revenue bonds for construction.
Well, Mr. Chairman, the report that the department had referred to has not yet been prepared, but the only reason I wanted to hold it was that I was just perhaps, you know, thinking that we could look at actually providing some general funds. I think in the interest of moving the bill along, I would suggest that we not hold it, but rather look at this in the context of our overall, not hold the bill, but go ahead and authorize the issuance of revenue bonds and look at the, you know, at the issue when we discuss the capital budget. So with that, I would move that we pass out SB 236 with individual recommendations.
Is there objection? So ordered. Next bill is Senate Bill number 288 on the Real Estate Commission. I believe Senator Binkley had some questions on it, and my recommendation to the committee is to put a zero fiscal note on the bill, which I would endorse, and that would make that would not allow for the sit one seasonal occupational licensing examiner. This is Senator Rick Ewling in Anchorage, and those present today are Senator Zaroff, Senator Duncan, Senator Frank, Senator Pierce, Senator Binkley, and myself. We are now on Senate Bill number 288. Relating to the Real Estate Commission and providing for an effective date. Senator Binkley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That's my primary concern, again, is a fiscal note. I don't think we need to hire another state employee for this position or spend the additional money that's necessary to support that position. I'm not convinced that it's actually necessary, this continuing education scheme, but as long as there's a zero fiscal note that comes out of this committee, I don't have any objection to go ahead and moving the bill out of committee, although I may not support it on the floor itself.
Is there any other discussion on the bill? Senator Frank? Senator Frank, do you want to make a motion?
Oh, yes. I would move that we pass out SB, I guess it's committee
Senate Bill 288.
Yeah, Senate Bill 288. Is that a committee substitute? I'm not sure.
It is the original bill, I believe.
Original bill with no amendments? Well, maybe we should amend it.
Is there objection to passing the original bill out with no amendments?
Sponsor substitute.
Okay. Sponsor substitute
for Senate Bill number 288, the individual recommendations along with the accompanying zero fiscal note.
Sponsor substitute for 288 has passed out. Any objections? So ordered. Senator Cockrell, your bill's been disposed of.
Pardon?
Your bill's been disposed of.
And let me grab
which way? Into the garbage. Pass it out.
This is a bill.
I could have put a little hand up
there. You, Jim, did you want to? I think all the power people are here today. They need to give her a presentation.
Yeah. Oh, they don't want to give a presentation, but I just want to give it to Tuesday if I could.
Yeah. Okay, are we off teleconference now? Thank you all for being on teleconference.
Because I've got questions up. Don't ask me about
that. Next bill up is Senate Bill number 238, an act related to the Power Project Fund and the powers of the Alaska Power Authority to finance and make loans from the Power Project Fund to sell waste heat and providing for an effective date. Brent Petrie, I believe. Is our spokesman. Let me just double check our sign-in sheet here. Brent Petrie, and then we'll have Dave Hutchins, and those are the two people I have on the list. Brent, did you want to come up and explain the bill and what it does?
Yes, Mr. Chair, my name is Brent Petrie. I'm Director of Agency Operations for the Alaska Energy Authority. And what this bill would do is provide a means of enhancing credit for revenue bond issues, which we would propose to use to provide a pool of funds for loaning to basically utilities, school districts, for power generation purposes, for energy conservation purposes, and waste heat systems. Right now we have a large number of small utilities, mainly in rural Alaska, that have some difficulty borrowing from conventional banks. We have a loan portfolio of about $38 million, about a $2 million annual revenue stream. And what this bill would propose to do is allow us to pledge part of that revenue stream as security on a bond issue. And we estimate for every $10 million that we would be able to pledge as security on such an issue, we would be able to raise an additional $10 million in capital. We have met with Alaska Rural Electric Co-op, and they do have some amendments that they would like to propose to this bill.
Mm-hmm.
We do agree with those amendments. We worked on them with them. And what those amendments would do is basically narrow the scope for the purposes for which we would be able to loan funds under this bill. If there's any questions...
Well, Mr. Petrie, do we have those in our file, Carol? Do we have those amendments in our file? Are they the ones proposed by ARECA, A-R-E-C-A?
Yes.
Okay. I have one, and then I have another one by the Labor and Commerce Committee.
The Labor and Commerce might have been a one-word.
Yeah, it was a change of deleting the term reserves.
That was about 6 months ago. Okay.
That's
we agree with that amendment, too.
Okay, do we have questions on the bill? Let's look at the fiscal notes. There is a zero fiscal note on the bill.
That's right.
It passed out of the Labor and Commerce Committee with two due passes and a no recommendation from Senator Fakes.
Three due passes.
Senator Duncan, do you want to take a look at the bill?
Mr. Chairman, I would, even before adopting the amendments, if we could just hold it until... When are we meeting again, Tuesday?
Tuesday.
Tuesday, I would appreciate that.
Okay. Are there any other questions for Brent? Let's see if Dave Hutchins is here, because he was also scheduled to sign in. Let's try to get all the questions on the table. Hi, Dave.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning. I want to make it clear that ARECA does support the thrust of this legislation, which is to establish the revolving nature of the power project loan fund. We have one problem with the bill, which could easily be resolved with a little redrafting. And if I could take just a few minutes of the committee's time to explain the background to the problem.
Okay.
It's on page 4. Where in lines 11 and 12, it puts the school districts, regional education attendance areas, regional housing authorities, and business enterprises into the same category as utilities for borrowing money from this revolving loan fund. And we understand that the principal purposes for their being able to borrow the loan funds are for waste heat and energy conservation and this sort of thing as the major thrust of why they need to borrow. We certainly have no objections to that at all. What we are concerned about is this would open the door for school districts to borrow money from this fund to finance power generation projects in competition with the local utility. And that's a constant problem we have in the small communities around the state, is to prevent losing the larger customers like that. When you lose the large customers, you tend to lose the feasibility for these small systems. That's the reason for this amendment that we'd worked out with the representatives of the Energy Authority. I'd had one of my active members, Bob Martin, manager at Clinkett Haida, with me the other day when we met with the Energy Authority to work out these amendments, and we're satisfied that this would be a satisfactory defensive amendment so that the problem doesn't get worse with the passage of this bill. It does not solve the problem that we're having in the rural areas with the schools dropping off the utility system, but the solution to that problem really is not germane to this bill. We need to do that in an education bill somewhere, and we need to visit with the committee further at some point about that.
Senator Frank.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That's an intriguing question or a problem. Why would there be a circumstance where they could generate their own for less than the utility was able to provide it for?
The reason is that they don't typically have a full cost accounting. They generally compare only their cost of fuel with the cost of power from the utility, because for the most part the generation facilities are given to them as a grant from the legislature,
And they typically don't even allocate the personnel costs to the operation of it. They say, well, this is somebody we've worked with, and this is just other duties as assigned, rather than allocating the time to that function.
Mm. Well, Mr. Chairman, I would encourage Rika to bring that issue back before us, because I'd hate to see us building inefficient or unnecessary projects.
At one time, Mr. Chairman, the state government, this was in the Hammond administration, had a policy requiring all state-supported schools to use power from the local utility when there was one. And that policy has sort of lapsed by lack of attention through the years. And in the last couple of years, it has become a very serious problem for schools to start to put in their own generation and drop off the utility system.
That just drives the cost to the consumer up, to the rest of the village up, doesn't it?
Yes, sir.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Binkley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, but how about when it's more efficient for the school to do that, Dave?
There are cases, particularly in Southwest Alaska, where there really is no functioning utility as such. There may be a small system for distribution, and they don't really have facilities to be able to operate efficiently for generation. And in some cases, you have systems where the school, in effect, is the generation utility and then sells to the local distribution facilities owned by the community. And that would be permitted to continue. I say permitted to continue. They'd even be able to borrow funds from this program under this amendment that would work out with the Energy Authority. The Energy Authority is very sensitive to that problem. We're more knowledgeable about that circumstance than we were.
Thank you. Senator Pierce?
I have a question, but it's actually probably for Mr. Petrie.
Ms. Petrie, can you come forward again? Thank you.
Thanks. On page 4, grant line 19, why are we deleting the word small scale?
I think there was no definition of small scale anywhere in this legislation. So this change, it would be available for any power project, no matter what size.
So that's a change from the present use of the revolving loan fund. That's in the statute now.
That's in the statute now, but there's no clear definition of small scale in this part of the statute.
So how has the, if I could go ahead, so how has the Power Authority decided what they can use the revolving loan fund for in terms of size? Or have you just gone ahead and?
The size has, in my opinion, been generally small, except in the case of Sitka, where money was loaned from this fund for a 20-megawatt hydroelectric plant. I wouldn't consider a 20-megawatt hydroelectric plant small scale. Generally, these have been for small diesel generators, line extensions in small communities.
Well, I guess, is there something else large scale on the horizon that is leading you to want to delete the small scale? And I'm just asking because I don't want to find out later that by this tiny change, we've done something that's going to take away from the Power Authority the ability to have funds to do some of the small, more rural projects because they're out doing some mega project.
The largest thing that I could imagine right now on the horizon that might be financed through this program, if it went through, would be a project in Unalaska, which would be a 12-megawatt geothermal plant. There's some discussion about that, but that's the largest project that I'm aware of at the present time as far as power production.
Okay. Do you know if there was any discussion of defining small scale rather than just deleting it? I mean, obviously, it was put there for a purpose.
No, there really wasn't much discussion of defining small scale. We do have another section of our statute that deals with feasibility studies, and in that portion, anything under 1.5 megawatts has some abbreviated procedures that we go through. Basically, anything that would be over 25 megawatts would be large scale.
Well.
Senator Pierce, continue.
Okay, and if that's true, and if Sitka was just 20, then I guess I still don't see why we're deleting it. If you use 25 as a rule of thumb.
If there wasn't, this was an attempt to clean up this part of the bill, not having any definition for small scale. There wasn't a lot of trying to focus in on a particular size of a plant that would be funded under this program.
Are there any other questions? If there are no other questions, Senator Duncan, take a look at that between today and Tuesday. Next bill on the calendar is going to be the Marine Highway Bill. Senator Duncan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That's Senate Bill 428, which adds new sections to Alaska Statute 19.65, establishing the Alaska Marine Highway System Fund and making provisions for its budgeting. The bill that's before us today is identical to House Bill 439, which was introduced by the governor at the beginning of this session. I believe it's important that the measure be acted on this session by the legislature. It is my hope that concurrent action on this bill, as well as the House bill moves, will result in timely consideration of the issue. The intent behind the bill is to allow the Marine Highway System to use the revenues it generates so it can provide service in a consistent and enhanced fashion. As pointed out in the governor's transmittal letter, which should be in the packets, I hope, the bill does not violate constitutional provisions related to the prohibition of dedicated funds. The proposed fund is subject to annual appropriation by the legislature. The legislation establishes a special account in the general fund for fiscal year, beginning for fiscal year 1991. These monies would then be available for use by the Alaska Marine Highway System in fiscal year 1992. There's also, of course, information in the packet on a proposal provided by Alaska Marine Highway System, and also zero fiscal notes from the Department of Transportation, Public Facilities, and Revenue and Administration. I think you've also got a section or a bill analysis as part of your packet. The committee substitute approved by the Senate Transportation Committee included two amendments making only minor language changes. I could run through those if you wanted me to. There was nothing in those amendments to alter the overall intent of the bill as I just described it. Those are the only changes. I believe that the bill does represent a vital key to the future of the Alaska Marine Highway System. Of course, that's a very important part of the entire state's transportation system, and I think the bill does deserve committee support. I would leave the real details of explaining the bill to the system director, Mr. Ayers, who I think can do a much better job than I can.
Okay, Mr. Ayers, did you want to come forward?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jim Ayers. I'm System Director of the Alaska Marine Highway.
Just a minute. Let's just double check. There's no teleconference. It was just for Grace Oakley, I think.
But you can use the mic anyway if you'd like.
Go ahead, Jim.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think that the Senator outlined the bill pretty well. There are a couple of things that I did want to point out that have been substantive questions raised by other legislators and were raised in the Senate Transportation Committee. First, this bill will be the first bill, although the system has been operating within the state for 25 years. The statutes have not provided any clear goals or directions or purpose of the Alaska Marine Highway System, and although we sometimes discount the importance of purpose of sections of statutes, one of the first things this bill does is identify that there is an Alaska Marine Transportation System and give it some specific purposes and goals. Secondly, that this bill begins to put the responsibility of managing the Marine Highway System, including accurately planning, scheduling, and budgeting for the operations on the shoulders of the administration of the Alaska Marine Highway System. Thirdly, this bill does not change or alter any of the authority that you, the legislature, has. It is not a dedicated fund and in no way remove the responsibilities or the authority that the legislature has for appropriation. It would take an annual appropriation. We would submit a budget just like we do today. forth, this, this particular bill, I think is, was stated pretty well when we, in the governor's transmittal letter, that there's been no articulated role for the Marine Highway System. There's been neither an expression of commitment nor a responsibility to maintain service at an adequate level. Nor has there been any direction to hold the system's management accountable for the decisions that result in what the public perceives as a decline in level of service. And in conclusion, Mr. Chairman, as I kind of like to introduce kind of the bill itself, this is an approach that recognizes that the Marine Highway System is unlike almost all other forms of state government, inasmuch as we generate between $35 and $40 million a year and transport some 400,000 people at the responsibility and risk of the state of Alaska. The graphics, I'll point out, I brought those forward. There's no one assigned, nor did we contract for that. There's a guy in our office who does scheduling and works on other projects and did that in an evening and over last weekend, and so I want to bring that to your attention. They are good graphics.
I also want to point out that your vessels, there are 8 vessels operating, but Chilcat does not operate currently, and it would take a major investment to bring the Chilcat out of service. The 4 mainline vessels, the Matanuska, the Mal, the Taku, and the Columbia, the largest ship, make up the mainline service. The Tustamina, as you know, is the only ocean-going vessel we have, and there's some major problems with having only one ocean-going vessel, which means there's no substitute for her when she's out of service. The Bartlett serves the Prince William Sound area, and the Leconte and the Aurora serve the northern and southern southeast, respectively, and when one of them is out of service, the other fills in and does what's called a tramper run from the entire southeast. The Chilcat is the oldest vessel, as I mentioned, and is not in necessarily gross disrepair, but because she is so old and she has shaft problems, it would take approximately $200,000 to bring her out of service, or back into service, and then probably some $300,000 to $350,000 a year in crewing, personnel, and other costs to operate her. There is not, she's not a smooth riding vessel, known otherwise as the Dramamine Dream. I had recommended that she be surplus. We've never surplused a vessel, so we're now discussing what that means.
To ask the Wickersham.
The Wickersham was not necessarily surplus. She was owned and under a leasing arrangement, and because she was a foreign bottom, was ultimately then the ownership was transferred back to the Commission. Before the Columbia actually got built, which is a whole other discussion. The fund that's, I just want to run through that. I don't want to take up a lot of your time, but I'd be glad to answer specific questions. These mainline vessels right here constitute about 135 to 140 weeks of service. Part of the problem the Marine Highway System has every year is we get into struggles with you because there's supplemental discussions. You want to know, as you do in other budgets, tell me exactly how much it's going to cost, and then spend that amount and no more than that. Then when vessels get laid up, what happens is around this time of year, the system panics and we lay up vessels to save money or to try and trim the budget back, or we come in for a supplemental. I'll be glad to go through or bring you a history of the finances of the Marine Highway System. It's pretty difficult to get, but I've done the last 5 years and it's kind of interesting. Generally, the Marine Highway System has lapsed money in the years when she's gotten a supplemental, and she's had a supplemental every year except for 1 year, which was 1986, when you funded her at some $68+ million.
That's the only year. In the last 20 years, Jim?
In the last 10 years that I know. Before that, it was much lower kind of situation. The number of things that caused that. The age of the vessels is the most substantial issue facing us today. Ridership is up. Our target this year is 400,000 passengers. We'll go over 400,000, is my opinion, in FY91, beginning in July 1st. When I'm talking about this year. Actually, beginning FY91, we'll hit 400,000, is my opinion, unless there's a major disruption in service like a labor problem. The average age in Bethel, if you look at the dates, is over 20 years old. And these three, the sister ships, the Blue Canoes, designed by Phillips Pauling, those vessels were all built in 1963. The Malice Beam is due for major refurbishment this year, including new generators, and we'll end up spending like $6 to $12 million on her over the next 5 years to get another 15 years out of her. Before we do that, one of the first things I did when I came in is I've ordered ship condition surveys on every vessel. It's just a basic principle, I think, that we all can understand, and that is the Marine Highway System has $1 billion in assets, not only these vessels, but terminals. We're reorganizing how we do things, get a complete inventory, get a condition survey of our assets, including these vessels. And we'll get three condition surveys this year, and we will then be able to talk to you about what that means. The fund itself, currently this is how it operates. You may or may not look at revenues when you appropriate the money for the Marine Highway System. Last year, we cut the budget from about $66 million down to about $63 million. That did not necessarily change how much it cost the general fund. What we did was lay up vessels, and so that meant we reduced the revenues. It did not necessarily save money when we cut the budget last year. And so when we bring the, as you know, you just dealt with the supplemental actually for $3 million would take us back to approximately $66 million, and that actually will cost the general fund probably a little less than $1 million ultimately, because we will generate revenues by bringing vessels out. Under the bill, what will happen next year is, as we gather the funds, they will go into the Marine Highway Fund. You will appropriate, assuming that you appropriate some amount of money, hopefully, to the Alaska Marine Highway System, and that will come out of the general fund this year, and we will do that just like every other year for the last 25 years. Then in FY92, this time next year, we will have a specific amount of money, which we're predicting will be around $37 million coming in the Marine Highway Fund. We won't have the last 2 months, but we will have probably some $30 million in the fund, and we'll be seeking an appropriation of general fund of approximately $31 million next year. That then will, we will then bring our budget to you, and you, we will ask for an appropriation from the Marine Highway System Fund for that budget. The idea being that what we hope to do is you would then be able to fund 100% of the operation of the Marine Highway Fund. We will continue to work towards increasing our revenues so that you will know, and as you deal with the reality of future budgets, you'll have a predictable level of funds that you know it's going to take to operate the Marine Highway System, and the responsibility of generating additional funds will fall on our shoulders, except for capital. And we would hope that we will increase our revenues if management's doing its job while continuing to provide a base level of service, eventually getting to the point where we would have a reserve in the Marine Highway Fund so that we would, as we needed to, as we had an emergency or a need for a supplemental, we would have those funds available. We would still go back to you and ask for authority to expend from our fund. And you would then begin to have a predictable level of service, predictable and reliable level of service, and there would also be a projected or predictable level of money that's going to be required from the general fund. In your packet, there's a number of pages of information that go with this. This is basically a draft of the financial plan we tried to hammer down in the last 120 days that gives you a picture. What I'm trying to do is develop kind of a 20-year financial plan that would allow us to take a look at not only maintaining the level of service at a predictable general fund amount so that we could lock in if you were to look at the general fund cost of some, whatever that number is, in actual expenditures for the future. The Marine Highway System is one of those systems where, except for capital, you would be able to predict how much it's going to cost the general fund, putting the responsibility to generate additional monies on the system itself. Also included in this financial plan is a discussion of what we expect in capital costs. This also includes the scenario of developing a replacement fund. Eventually, one of these ships is going to have to be replaced, but...
Now, Jim, we don't owe any money on any of these ships.
No, you own them outright.
All we do is pay for the labor.
We only pay for labor and refurbishment.
That's right.
Okay. One more thing. This is simply an example of what I think is necessary in order for you to have a solid financial plan. We need a stable level of funding so that we can predict what's going to happen. We need the authority to receive the funds so that we can begin to make decisions about about rates and charges, not only scheduled tariff rates, but things like food and entertainment, so that we can begin to make management decisions about how to expand our decision, how to expand the system based on our revenue decisions. And then the third piece of this would be to have a replacement and refurbishment program so that we could begin to build what most transportation systems have, which is a capital reserve fund, which ultimately is what all the infrastructure of the state ought to do, but I don't want to get in, I'm only doing this piece right now. But this would be a capital reserve and replacement fund so that we could deal with the reality that these vessels are eventually going to have to be refurbished and replaced. We do receive federal money each year, that's also in your packet, for refurbishment, and ultimately the federal government would also participate in replacement. But all of the federal money depends on the proration of federal dollars coming in the state. As you know, the state gets about $140 million in federal dollars, federal funds, federal highway dollars, and those are then distributed throughout the state. And it varies what the marine highway system gets. There's always been great arguments, should we get more, should we get less? I guess it's actually kind of a blessing that we are able. They identified in 1974 that the marine highway system was eligible under Federal Highway Act authority as a bridge. It's identified as a bridge because it connects both state and interstate highways. That's a brief kind of quick talk overview.
Senator Binkley?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a quick question, Jim. Is there any restrictions on the legislature going in and pulling any of the money out of that fund and utilizing it for other purposes?
Mr. Chairman? Senator Binkley, there is absolutely no restriction on this fund as far as your legislative authority is concerned. There was a lot of discussion in the Senate Transportation about that very issue, and at that time the Attorney General's office came to discuss that issue, and it's our understanding that your attorneys and our attorneys agree that your legislative authority to move and appropriate money is no way encumbered in this act.
So, Mr. Chairman, for example, if we get down to budgets of $1.6 billion or $1.7 billion and everybody's got to take an appropriate amount of reductions, there's no restriction on the legislature going in and taking all or a portion of those program receipts if it's needed for other areas of state expenditures.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Binkley, that's my understanding, and that was what the attorneys discussed very thoroughly, and that's absolutely true. It was discussed from both sides of that street, some people being concerned that it could ultimately be raided if it began to work, and the other side of the street was, yeah, but what if we really needed it? So it was, and the attorneys agreed that in either case, if a majority of both bodies decided to appropriate those funds short of a veto, that's exactly what would happen.
Senator Binkley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Then what, practically, really, what good does it do you to have that?
What good does it do to have the fund?
I mean, if it's really just a part of the general fund and it's just colored a different color, but we can utilize it as though it were the general fund.
I've been listening to you.
What does it really give you beyond what you already have?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Binkley, I've been listening to your debate over the last few days about the budget, the expenditures, spending limit discussions. I think the important issue that I'm trying to bring forward is that the infrastructure of this state is going to be essential as we move through the decline in Prudhoe Bay. This is a plan to set in place a procedure for you to say, we know the Marine Highway can operate on this, and put the onus of the responsibility for operating on a specific, predictable level on the management.
so that we're making decisions, and it's unlike other structures, and so it needs different kind of tools. Without that, you will not have a clear picture, and we won't be sitting over there making financial plans. We'll just come over here every year and hope we can get whatever we can get, and it'll continue to do this. And so it is a financial tool more than it is a mechanism for appropriation. It's a financial planning tool. And hopefully what we would do is provide you the information that says to you, you need this infrastructure if you're going to have a healthy economy. And in order to maintain this infrastructure, there's got to be a reliable, predictable funding mechanism. This is a reliable, predictable funding mechanism that we think gets you through the next 20 years.
But it's, Mr. Chairman, it doesn't seem very reliable and very predictable if it's at the whim of 11 and 21 in the legislature.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Binkley, I agree, and certainly if I don't think we're at a stage to get in to a dedicated fund discussion, because then we'd have a whole bunch of those, and I agree with that you need to have the flexibility to deal with emergencies. On the other hand, I think that it is different enough that it would cause a lot of consternation. It would take a terrific emergency for people to decide to dismantle the base. It is my opinion, Senator, that to begin to dismantle the infrastructure is the beginning of a more serious problem than even has been discussed in the last few weeks for the state of Alaska. At the point that we would have to raid the infrastructure, we are dismantling kind of the state's economic base, and I think that we'd have to be in serious trouble, but you probably need that flexibility. There could be a day that we needed that. I don't believe that there'd be 11 and 21 votes to do that without some real serious discussion about what it means to start dismantling your foundation. I mean, and that's the point that we're trying to make. That
we use that rather loosely, Jim.
What's that, foundation?
I said that the infrastructure you're using rather loosely.
The infrastructure? I'll quit using it. We are an essential part of the intermodal transportation system.
I understand that. Senator Frank.
Thank you. Jim, I can't see those figures because my eyes aren't as good as they used to be. But
somebody told me to get it all on one page and not bring 20 pages of numbers up here, and so that's the best I could do. But go ahead.
I was just going to say, the general fund portion of your plan, are you suggesting that would remain constant or would be increasing or over time? Perhaps it's right in my packet on that.
As far as the operations are concerned, based on what we know today, and we've been hearing this out for the last 120 days, and I believe that it's possible to develop a financial model for the main highway system that is a consistent number, and that number would be about $31 million per year. And I believe that if we manage the system right, that for operations, yes, it would be a predictable number. It will vary or vacillate in terms of capital because it depends on what we need to do with the vessels. But yes, I believe we can establish, if you give us the direction and you give us the $31 million a year, the marine highway system ought to be able to run for the next 15 years, and make other changes to what we do to generate revenues.
Okay, so you're talking about a nominal holding of the line with, first of all, let me say that I appreciate what you're trying to do, and I think it is a good idea to, even though, you know, the legislature is not giving up its ultimate authority, it is giving, providing some tools to provide the incentives to manage more efficiently or more effectively, with some bottom line responsibility that, you know, you're not coming back for any additional funds. You're going to have to generate them, and you're going to have the incentive to generate them. So there's some feel to it to me. So I guess it comes down to the legislature kind of making a, maybe not a commitment, but you could look at it another way. You could say, we're not giving you any more than $31 million. You got to go generate the rest. Would be another way of looking at it, and I guess that's perhaps the way I'm looking at it. How do you see it providing the incentive to generate additional funds?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Frank, I think that the reality of the Prudhoe Bay curve is beginning to set in on people. And I think that people, particularly in southeast and southwest, and now we know south central Alaska,
rely heavily on the marine highway system, and I think that that we all understand that we've got to at least try to do some things differently. The incentive will be there to make management decisions, because otherwise I'm going to be sitting here saying, gee whiz, I couldn't raise the rates, or I didn't do something, or I didn't make $35 million, I lost $5 million last year. And it is one of the systems that you have that you hold a manager accountable for. If I don't generate the money, I ought to be held accountable.
Senator Duncan?
Well, I think my question's been discussed, or my point's been discussed. I just wanted to make that. And, of course, on Senator Binkley's point, the bill itself indicates that nothing exempts us from the Executive Budget Act or dedicates revenues. Of course, we can't dedicate revenues constitutionally, and we still have all the power of appropriation. But the point that Senator Frank was making was one I wanted to make. The bill itself on page 2, lines 15 through 17, talks about that base level of funding, $31 million of general fund revenues, and says, provide a system that anticipates a predictable funding base appropriation of at least $31 million general fund in addition to gross revenue. So that's where the stability comes in. And then the efficiency, the major point of this, I believe, is to provide an incentive to employees and to those who operate the system to operate efficiently, because it's then up to them from that base level of funding to generate additional revenues to address increasing labor costs or fuel costs or whatever else it may be to expand the system. So I think it does offer real incentive for efficient operations and would be a real benefit, and I think Senator Frank was getting to that. And I didn't know if anyone had noted that figure in the bill. I neglected to mention that.
How much was it?
On page 2, it's just in the purpose section. It's not statute. It's not law, right? But it's in the legislative findings, yeah, purpose, right, and intent. It says, if I can read this all, in is the purpose of AS 19650502, subsection 4, provide a system that anticipates a predictable funding base of appropriations of at least $31 million each year from the general fund. So you're providing stability with that language and then encouraging efficiencies above and beyond that.
Well, I guess as I follow the marine highway system for like 4 or 5 years now, and it has been the procedure and purpose of the other directors that have been there that they are going to reduce the general fund amount requirement that's going in to the marine highway every year. And I mean, they've done a good job as far as getting revenues in, make no doubt about it. But it was my understanding that was going to be able to drop from 31 million. It started at 35, went to 31. Maybe it's going to go down to 25 million so that the actual injection of cash from the general fund was going to be dropping in future years. However, I do, now that Senator Duncan did bring that up between lines 15, 16, and 17, I read that stating that we would anticipate funding at least $31 million. I'd like to see it that if we could eventually get off the general fund requirements, that we could be a lesser amount than just the $31 million. Matter of fact, I think it's extremely expensive to run the system. Considering that we paid for, you know, all the ships are paid for, I understand they need some repair.
Mr. Chairman, there are a couple of responses to that. One, I think one of the things that's been noted, and you'll be glad to talk with your legislative staff, the marine highway system is a highway system. It is cheaper lane mile than any other system in the state of Alaska, and actually is competing with Northwest cost. It is the least expensive highway in the state. And there probably is a way for me to say this diplomatically, but I don't believe that this marine highway system will ever pay for itself if we want it to be a highway system. If we want it to be something different, if we do not expect it to be a highway system, then we could probably make money. But it means not serving a lot of communities that rely on this for their highway.
I know the merits of it, and I'm very...
No, I
understand that. What I'm saying is, and maybe we should look at an exemption from the Executive Budget Act as a requirement, because I think, from what I understand, the costs are high when you look at the labor costs, you look at the leave time and some of those kind of things. That's where your costs are.
Mr. Chairman, one other point to make on reducing general fund levels, let's say, to $25 million. What we found out through the supplemental process is as you reduce the general fund, I mean, you're really reducing the program receipts area dollar per dollar per... It appears.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean,
and I didn't point this out to indicate that we should be reducing the general fund level. I think what the system needs is stability if it's going to provide service. If it's going to provide a good level of service to communities in Southeast, and if it has that stability built into it, it can probably generate more program receipts than it presently is. The problem that the system has had is it's gone from year to year. Like this year, for example, the system was not sure when it could bring ferries online. You know, a number of those things occur. That doesn't make for good planning, nor allow you to effectively use your and efficiently use your vessels. And the stability, I think, is the most important aspect here.
My only concern would be the language they're using, the figure that had to be at least $31 million. Now that you brought it to my attention.
Mr. Chairman, let me say that I'd love nothing more, and actually there was one weekend where...
Maybe you need $45 million.
I went a little nuts on the couple people who've been running the computer models on this financial model that I've kind of designed. I'd love nothing more than to be sitting here showing numbers that decline from beginning in like 1996 down to the year 2000 so that I could be selling this in a more aggressive way. But I...
accountability, that we're going to be able to cut costs and all those kind of things. I understand the stability question. I understand that that's an infrastructure that's important, that it fits the need of Southeast and Southwest Alaska and so on. Senator Zaroff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Jim, on the revenue section, where does it show federal dollars?
Pardon me?
Where does it show federal dollars?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Zaroff, the federal dollars that come into the Alaska Marine Highway System are not used for the operations. The federal dollars that come into the Marine Highway System are used only for the capital projects and are shown, actually you have to go to the financial model, but they would not pass through this fund because the capital dollars would not pass through this fund.
But how much are they?
How much are they?
Yeah.
Again, Mr. Chairman, they vary. I would want to get you a financial history, but it varies in FY89.
Mr. Chairman, I didn't go down far enough on this graph example. About three-quarters of the way down, it shows capital funding source, federal revenue, and then it lists it all the way on through.
$11 million?
$34 million?
So it's $7 million?
Yes.
5 and 89,
10, 7 and 90.
Right.
Okay.
11, 91.
I mean, that's part of the cost, too, but you know, even though it's in a separate category. Senator Duncan.
Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to respond briefly to your question on accountability, and Mr. Ayers might want to respond on this, but this bill in no way lessens accountability of the system as far as I can see it. I mean, the accountability is still there, and the accountability is there to the administration and to the legislature, because as long as you go through the Executive Budget Act, we have to do all the appropriations. We cannot dedicate funds. We're doing all the appropriations, so you're still accountable just as you were before. Is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Senator Duncan, one of the discussions we've had is that we think that it's going to make it, the accountability is going to fall on the manager who's going to be sitting here. General manager, this system is going to be sitting here at some point giving you a report and saying, and therefore we need $31 or $30 million, but hopefully they will not be sitting here saying, geez, I've really done a terrible job and I need $40 million this year. You mentioned cost, Mr. Chairman, and I think it's also going to be incumbent. It's going to be revealing when we begin to talk about, it's going to be in labor's best interest to also see that the system is run efficiently, smoothly, and generates additional revenues.
Well, the reason I was going to, that's a good point. The reason I was looking at what we were going to do, we're going to have a bill coming up here on AHFC, which is going to mean an exemption from the Executive Budget Act. We've got groups of people in Alaska that want to make all these entities separate organizations that don't have any responsibility to the state. So I was just wondering, the philosophy has been, if we can make it an independent animal that's separate from the state, maybe we can make it run more efficiently. I mean, there's pros and cons to that. Doesn't Senator Jones have a bill in to do that, to set up an authority? That a possibility, Senator Duncan?
Mr. Chairman, that bill's in Senate State Affairs, and I think it's a compromise position on that would not make it a separate authority at this point. That's a pretty major step, and I think Mr. Senator Jones is not going in that direction now, but to do an interim step to try to bring more stability to management. Separate authorities, if we just get on that, work very well for something like the Alaska Railroad, for example, because that can be a profit-making operation.
Mm-hmm.
The Marine Highway System can never be a profit-making operation, as Mr. Ayer said, if we're going to run it as a highway. We should try to bring about efficiencies and do the best we can, but no highway in the state makes profits. It just doesn't happen. So
I don't expect it ever to make a profit.
Yeah.
I think there's some costs in there that are pretty expensive, though.
Yeah, they are.
Senator Frank?
I was just going to say that if we endowed it with $1 billion or so, the way we did AHFC, they could probably make some bucks. I'm not suggesting it.
Mr. Chairman, if that's an offer,
we could change the governor's education.
They keep bonding, I'm sure. Can they?
The highway endowment?
Probably get more votes.
Just one last question, maybe to Senator Duncan on this. Really, then, by passing this bill out, we are sort of preempting doing anything from a standpoint of an authority. This would take the place, would it not take the place of that?
No, Mr. Chairman. In fact, I think these two concepts could go hand in hand if we were to do an authority concept. This is just talking about setting up a special the fund where the program receipts would flow into, and then we appropriate that money out. The authority concept is much broader than that. It talks about the total management of the system. What is being proposed now as a CS in State Affairs, for your information, is a commission where we'd appoint a Marine Highway Commission to oversee the operations, and they would even appoint the director of the system instead of having that a political appointee, so we could have some stability in management. So the authority concept may be worked on in the future, but I think this year we're looking at an interim step, if it's possible, to bring stability to management. And I think that's key to the system, bringing stability to management, and I think bringing stability to funding as best we can is key to the system also. So they work hand in hand.
Maybe Mr. Ayers would have a comment on stability of management, you know, in light of the, you know, impending election and stuff.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Frank, I'm a relatively balding, stable male.
He's been there 3 months. He's stable.
Any other comments on the bill? Any other testimony?
Thank you very much.
Thank you,
Mr. Chairman. Appreciate
and
it.
And there's no one else to testify on the bill, Senator Duncan.
Mr. Chairman, are you ready for a motion? I would move we report out to CS for Senate Bill Number 428.
Is there objection? So ordered. Next bill on the calendar is Senate Bill Number 416. There is a similar bill in the House bill, if you turn your page. So the House bill is the one that's gotten here first, I guess. Isn't that right, Carol? And we're going to take up the bill. They are identical bills. Okay. Duncan, did you want to come and explain the changes? There are two bills before us, Senate Bill 416 and Committee Cell Substitute for House Bill Number 452. And if you'll explain the differences and what your recommendation is on.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. These two bills started out as identical bills, and they were introduced at my request by the Legislative Council. As we went through the House process, there were one technical amendment that was made that made sure that we could still subpoena objects. That was an oversight in the drafting of the amendment. There was another amendment that was made at the request of the court system, and I think it's a good one, which would say that sealed court records could only be obtained by subpoena by our office. And there was also an additional amendment made that we would not look at active criminal investigations nor records that might identify confidential police informants. Other than that, it's the identical. It's the same bill. I think the amendments help strengthen the bill. I frankly am not anxious to see a Christmas tree of exemptions made on this bill because that makes it very difficult for us to do the work that we should be doing. But I think at what we have at this point, I think this is certainly an enhancement to our statute and helps us do our job much better. I've sent all of you letters that describe the bill, and if you have any questions, I could either go over the merits of the bill itself, or I'd be happy to...
Sorry, I missed the exemption. I apologize. What's the exemption?
There was a requirement that if we want to look at sealed court records, that we need to subpoena those, and rather than just going in and requesting them. And that, the subpoena process is one that the court system is comfortable with. It's something that they can live with easily. I have no problem with that. The other objection was looking at active police investigations or looking at records that would identify the identity of confidential police informants. The intent on that was to make sure that active criminal investigations, evidence that was being collected and this kind of thing, did not get messed up, and that the integrity of that evidence wasn't harmed so that it couldn't be presented later on in court. And of course, the one on the confidential police informants was, frankly, a life safety concern that people had.
Senator Duncan.
I was just curious, how often do you have to look at sealed court records, for example? Is that something?
Rarely. Candidly, I don't remember ever needing to do that. But the court system was concerned about the access to the confidentiality of the documents, and they were comfortable in having this kind of restriction.
Are there any other questions? Senator Frank and then Senator Zara.
Let me defer to Senator Zara.
Senator.
Thank you, Chairman. Under Section 1, maybe you can just refresh me, who appoints the ombudsman?
Who appoints the ombudsman?
Right.
The ombudsman is selected by a bipartisan committee of the House and Senate. And it goes through a selection process. The name is referred to a joint session of the House and Senate, must be confirmed on a two-thirds vote, then goes to the governor who can veto it for cause.
Okay, but I'm looking on line 13. If the position becomes available under an immediate circumstance.
I asked for that provision in case I get hit by a truck, sir.
Okay.
That makes sure that somebody has to be appointed to the office. A successor has to be appointed so that there is not difficulty should I die or be harmed or something like that.
So this is something that you would do while ombudsman yourself, that you would appoint someone then to take your place should something happen?
Yes, in fact, I have a person who acts as my deputy now, and what this does is that this requires that I would appoint somebody to act as my deputy. Right now, it's permissive. Right now, our statute says that I may appoint someone. I'm not required to. We have had a situation where there was no deputy appointed, and the stability of the office had some risk in case the person in office had an accident or something. That's the purpose of that change.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Then going on here to Section 2, then, that the person serving as acting ombudsman in the absence of the ombudsman then would have all of the same powers that the ombudsman has?
Yes, sir. They would essentially, if I became unable to serve because of illness, whatever, that person would then go in and act as the ombudsman until a new selection committee could be appointed and another appointment process could be made. It keeps the office stable while the reappointment process would occur.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, then just continuing, so then absence means then that you don't have the ombudsman there, but you have an acting, I mean, he is still in pretty much control of the office. It doesn't mean like if you're on vacation in California or something, or what is that? Florida. I've been thinking of California.
The intent of this was to make sure that should I not be able to serve any longer, all those things that my wife looks at my insurance policies for, sir, that there would be a way for the office authority to continue. This does also allow for, if I was out of state, for someone to take charge of the office during that interim period. Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Duncan.
No, I have no further questions.
Senator Pierce. Senator Frank.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Duncan. Move it.
I would move committee substitute for Senate Bill 416.
Any objection to the bill moving out of the committee with individual recommendations?
Mr. Ward.
Could I ask that you consider moving out the House version?
Yes.
Oh.
The House version.
Oh, yeah.
Any substitute for House Bill, why don't you make the motion for the House Bill 452 amendment?
What is it?
House Bill 52 amendment.
House Bill 452.
What, Senator Zaroff has one more question on it before we...
Oh, see what you did now? He's going to ask all these questions.
Now, Mr. Chairman, how come you didn't have an effective date on this?
I'm sorry, it didn't come across the draft. I didn't think of it.
Let's double check that.
There is no effective date. Of course, if you move the House Bill, then that would require a title change, and I'm not going to go through those motions, but it seems like if this is something there that you were wanting to do, it should have had an immediate effective date. Now you've got to wait until
90 days
after the governor signs it.
It would be nice to have it effective earlier, but we've waited 15 years for this. I can have whatever I can get at this point.
Mr. Chairman, you want to wait another 90 days?
As long as you can...
I'd be comfortable.
As long as you can survive 90 days.
I mean, there's some people who wish...
No more questions.
Okay, so, Senator Duncan...
Yeah, I would withdraw the motion I made and move that we report out committee status to House Bill 452, State Affairs. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. So ordered. Okay, Sally Smith, I see, is here. Let's see now. Did anybody? I guess we didn't have anybody down for Duncan Fowler's bill. Now we go to committee substitute for House Bill number 89, Representative Barr. This is an old friend that's been around for a while.
Where's everybody at?
They all left.
Any age
not
here?
Problems.
Huh?
Okay,
you got a conflict on this, Sheriff.
Who, Sally Smith? Are you signed up to testify on the bill?
Yes, I am, Mr. Chair, but I'd like Bob Stallmaker too. Here.
Okay, Bob.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Bob Stallmaker, Deputy Director for the Division of Retirement and Benefits. It's my understanding that the version that we're aware of right now is House Bill 89. Is there a proposed committee substitute?
No, there's not.
Okay.
Perhaps Representative Navarre has one, but I don't have one.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, the administration is opposed to this bill on a couple grounds. One is that there is an additional cost to the teacher's retirement system. It's not a substantial cost, but it is a cost nonetheless. And secondly, we feel that this bill continues to provide additional inequities within the teacher's system by allowing part-time service to be treated the same as full-time service when reaching eligibility for 20-year retirement. And I guess I'll be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Duncan.
I just now found a fiscal note, Bob. What are you saying here now? Is an employer cost, you're saying?
Through the chair, Senator Duncan, there will be an increase to the employer contribution rate of 0.06%, because what this bill would be allowing is teachers to, in essence, mix and match full-time and part-time service to reach the 20-year threshold for retirement. And that means if you currently have a teacher that has 14 years of full-time and 6 years of part-time, under the current statutes, that would equate to 17 years of service. So the teacher would have to work another 3 years before they could retire under the 20 and out. With passage of this bill, that teacher could retire immediately, because the 6 years of half-time service would be treated just as if they were full-time years of service.
Mr. Chairman, okay, but it does not affect the actuarial soundness of the fund.
Through the chair, Senator Duncan, we're getting at an interesting place now with the size of the retirement funds. They're getting up into the billions of dollars of value, and certainly a bill that has a small fiscal impact can't necessarily be measured as to the funding ratio of the systems. I think it still needs to be understood that there is a cost to this bill, and, but the cost is small enough that it does not impact the funding ratio of the systems.
So there would not be an adverse impact on the actuarial soundness of the TRS fund?
Through the chair, Senator Duncan, there would be an additional cost, but not measurable in comparison to the total size of the fund.
Senator Pierce?
I'm not going to try.
It's I believe there was some, and I don't know, the Senator, a representative of ours not here, but I believe there was some question about changing the title of the bill or doing something on it, so I don't have the full story on that yet. I will find it out. I don't want to pass it out until we know what we're going to do on it.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I just saw the memo, if I might.
Yes, Senator.
I know what you want to do, but I guess Representative Lahr is not here, but I know NEA is here, but I think what he was proposing, and I haven't looked at his amendment, I think it takes a title change, is to allow those teachers who would be affected by HB 89 the opportunity to take advantage of the retirement incentive program. Is that basically what he, and I don't know what impact that has here, and it would take a title change. I'm assuming he's still interested in pursuing that, but I don't know.
Is there anybody else that wishes to testify on the bill?
I'd ask Mr. Stallhager, but I don't know the answer.
The gentleman in the back. Have you signed up, sir?
Not over the video. Yes, I did sign up.
Okay, great. Come on, come forward.
Say,
you bet.
There are no questions. My letters should apply.
Okay. You are supporting the bill as it is right now without any changes to it, correct?
That's correct. However, we are interested in President Barr's.
Okay. Okay, the chair will be discussing that with Representative Barr. He's not here right now. We did have the bells this morning, so we will hold the bill over and take a look at it. And at this time, we're out of time, and we'll take up the public retirement bill next week. Okay, let's get the meeting started today. Today is Tuesday, March 13th, 1990. Senator Zaroff, Senator Binkley, Senator Fisher, Senator Pierce, and Senator Frank are present this morning. And this morning we will start out with a continuation of last week's calendar. Senator Fisher, you have been working on Senate Bill number 17.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I have a substitute over the weekend since the last meeting. What I've asked to have done was to take away the reference to mandatory Supreme Court review or anything dealing with the court, because I was informed that anything dealing with mandates of court would be 13 votes. And it started out, Mr. Chairman, asking to adjust all we were trying to do is get the death penalty instituted in the state of Alaska. So before you, you do have the draft. And if it'd be okay with you, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to have Mr. Chandler, in case you do have any questions. So, Mr. Chairman, I would propose that we adopt the this as a committee substitute.
Is there objection to the adoption?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Zara.
Which committee substitute is that?
It's 312-90
Chenoweth. Oh, okay. It's in the back.
No objection, so ordered. Mr. Chenoweth? You want to explain?
I have no presentation. I'm here to answer questions.
The big question is, I had asked about getting it so we don't need 14 votes on the floor to pass it, because it's telling the Supreme Court to do something, and this version, in your opinion, does not take 14 votes on the floor.
There is no reference in this bill for a court to the court rule change. You asked that they be deleted, and the provisions that affected court rule changes have been modified or removed from the bill in order to avoid that. There is still the two-thirds requirement on the effective date clause. I want to say that I have some hesitation about doing this. Under current law, the trial court, the judge, imposes sentence. As this bill has developed in its previous forms and in this form that's before you, the determination of the sentence is for the jury. The imposition, the determination to impose capital punishment is for the jury. This will be the first and only time in Alaska criminal law where the jury would have that role. Current court rules are fairly specific on what the judge must do as he or she takes on and discharges the role of imposing sentence. Those rules are intended to cover all situations, but in fairness, they don't contemplate, under current law, a role for the jury. For the first time, the legislature in this bill is saying that the jury has a role. Arguably, that change by the legislature in this bill would not require a court rule change, because you're adding the additional responsibility and assigning it to the jury in this case. But I will tell you that it's not, in my mind, free from doubt. And surely, in any challenge, if this bill becomes law, in any challenge that's raised as to an imposition of the death penalty, you're handing the attorney for the defendant an argument to use in challenging the legislation that's in front of you. The best argument that I can offer in defense of the removal of the references to the court rules changes at this time.
So it's your feeling that the legislation that's before us, without the court rule changes, would essentially mean that it could be challenged at a later time and make the law unconstitutional?
There are a lot of places that there are a lot of challenges that will come in under a death penalty statute. This is yet another one. It's not free from doubt in my mind that you're going to prevail, but I think the argument that I've tried to lay out for you offers you some defense for taking the action in removing the rules change references out of this legislation.
And Senator Fischer, the reason we're making the changes on it is because you don't have the votes or on the floor, is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, I think the people of the state of Alaska want to have some question about it, and it's not only in Alaska. If you looked at cable news network last night, the gubernatorial races throughout the country. It seems like in Texas, everybody running for governor is trying to be the champion of the death penalty. You go down to California, and I don't know, I think it's Feinstein, she's running for governor, she's even adopting the death penalty, because they know that the people want the death penalty there. And this is no different. I think to play the game where you need 14 votes, but in essence you need 11 for the death penalty, that's why I made the change. So we don't get down and have a head count and end up with 13 votes on the floor when we know that the general public wants it and we should only need 11.
Any other comments from members? Senator Binkley?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm a little bit leery of changing legislation just to accommodate a political or achieve a political end. I mean, if there's good sound reasoning to making the change in the legislation, that's one issue. But if we're just doing it to try and reach a political end, then I'm not sure that I can necessarily support that action. I'd like to hear from the Department of Law, possibly, also, on what they feel the implications are and how this might work and what difficulties they might foresee in prosecuting these cases with the proposed committee substitute.
Hey, Senator Zara?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I share the same concerns as Senator Binkley, and I would assume there that the Judiciary Committee has made and has gone through extensive hearings in the bill. This is probably quite a deviation from the direction in which the Judiciary Committee has made their recommendations of passing the bill out of the committee. And
I'm
very much concerned about that.
Senator Fischer?
I guess the thing is, it's not the Judiciary Committee's bill. I think that should be true of Senator Zara said. Therefore, it's my intent to get a capital punishment bill there. And that's what the general public wants. They don't want to stand there drafting around playing games and trying to say, well, this did happen because someone had wished to move to that committee. I think what they want to adopt the capital Senate and the House. And even in the beginning, when I first thought of this, I wasn't thinking of driving. I thought, well, that might make it a little more pleasant to somebody, so that came in. But this is a good issue for the last 6 years.
Well, there's still the option of adopting the Judiciary Committee substitute as well as either the Finance Committee substitute, is there not? Any other questions for Mr. Chenoweth? Are there any other questions for Mr. Chenoweth? No questions. We want to go to the department. Do we have anybody here? Senator Binkley wanted to talk to the Department of Law. We now, as you're aware, you have another packet of just fiscal notes on this that's in a separate packet because there are so many fiscal notes on the bill. And we should have some updated fiscal notes.
Lori Otto.
For the record, my name's Lori Otto. I represent the criminal division of the Department of Law. I guess I'd like to make a couple points. One is that the changes in the CS, and I just got a copy of it this morning and have gone over it very briefly, are not limited to taking out the court rules changes. If you look at page 8 of the bill, the CS, the judiciary CS, you'll see that there is a Article 3 that relates to sentence review and puts in specific sentence review provisions for capital cases that, if you look at page 9, starting at line 20, it specifically provides certain rights. This is of the judiciary CS, page 9, line 20.
Mr. Chairman, can we hold on just a second so we get that? Okay, are we not on the committee substitute?
What I'm trying to point out is that there are changes in the Finance Committee substitute that's been proposed, aside from taking out the reference to rules changes. That there in the judiciary CS was a specific sentence review provision set up for capital cases that had things in it like the defendant doesn't have to file a notice of appeal and the defendant can't be required to pay a fee and the entire record is automatically the record of the case on appeal that are put in presumably to provide greater protections for defendants in capital cases. Those have all been removed as well, I assume, because that is a situation where there would definitely need to be a rules change. But there is a substantive provision that's been taken out of the bill. That's point number one. Point number two is, you've just heard from Mr. Chenoweth that, you know, here's an argument that you can make to support taking out the rules changes in the title, but I would submit to you that under current law and under the current court rules, a pre-sentence report is required to be prepared in every felony case, that the judge has to consider certain factors in sentencing people on any criminal case, that there's an elaborate sentencing structure that this bill completely eliminates. This bill says no pre-sentence report. This bill says the judge doesn't consider those factors. This bill says the jury imposes sentences. That is a dramatic change from the court rules, and to be effective, it's our position that you need to have a court rules change in the title. And Senator Fisher referred earlier to playing games to get 14 votes, and with all due respect to Senator Fisher, who I like a lot, I think it's playing games with the people of Alaska to pass a law that has court rules changes in it, that you don't put court rules changes in the title, just so that you don't need the votes on the floor. And again, with all due respect, Senator Fisher, we don't believe that this statute will be effective to put the death penalty into Alaska simply because it doesn't have court rules changes in the title. And there are a whole series of cases talking about the necessity for the legislature to follow the constitutional mandate of putting court rules changes in the title, having a two-thirds vote. And that's not being followed in this bill, and the bill then will not have its intended result. It will not achieve its intended result.
Well, we obviously wanted to do it right here in the Senate Finance Committee so that whatever action that we do take here, that we do it properly. And Senator Fisher?
Chairman, I think what we have in the situation, you can find one attorney that says this and another attorney says that. I've been hearing that for the 7 years I've been down here. Let me ask a question. Don't you assume, we can make an assumption that no matter what comes out, it's still going to be challenged? I would suspect so, and I think that you would feel the same way.
Lori?
Through the chair, Senator Fisher, I think that it will be challenged, but I think that the Judiciary Committee tried to structure a bill that would withstand constitutional challenge, and there have been death penalty bills in other states that have withstood constitutional challenge, and the point I'm trying to make is it's our opinion that this bill will not withstand constitutional challenge simply because you've taken the rules change out. And I think that I listened to your counsel, and I heard a lawyer saying, it's not a very good argument, but here's an argument that you can make. I didn't hear Mr. Chenoweth saying, I'm confident you're going to win. I think this is something that will stand up. And I agree with Mr. Chenoweth that in every case, the state can come up with a counterargument to an argument raised by a defendant. Some are good arguments, some are weak arguments. This is a real weak argument.
Questions? Senator Binkley, do you have any more questions for the department?
I don't understand all the technical aspects of this, Mr. Chairman. Obviously, in judiciary, they went through a lot of this, but the pre-sentencing report, so what we've really done, to make sure I understand this correctly, we've eliminated all of that Article 3, the sentence review, so that there's no real review of the sentencing by a judge?
Well, the pre-sentence report is a different issue, through the chair, Senator Binkley. There was a sentence review, a special review of the death penalty set out in the Judiciary Committee substitute. In addition to that, the...
Review by the judge?
Review by the Supreme Court of Alaska.
Oh, I see.
It's an appellate process. So that was taken out entirely. And so, of course, if you take the section of the bill out entirely, you don't need to have a court rules change on it. That is completely supportable. The problem is the other court rules change related to sentencing procedure. And in current sentencing procedure, as set out in the court rules, there's a pre-sentence report. There are certain time frames for doing everything. The judge has to consider a number of different factors before imposing sentence, has to follow a certain procedure in imposing sentence. All of that is changed by, if you look at page 5 of the CS proposed by Senator Fisher, starting at line, I guess it's line 23, it's an Article 2 on imposition of sentence, setting out a specific sentencing procedure for capital felonies. That procedure is different than the procedure set out in the court rules in felony cases, for felony cases. So it's changing the court rule. And that's what I'm saying there's a problem with, because that's not referenced in the title. And our court says, even if there's a two-thirds vote on a bill, even if you do have the votes on the floor, if it's not referenced in the title and it's not specifically voted on as a court rules change, it's not constitutional. It's not in compliance with the constitutional requirement that court rules changes need a two-thirds vote in each house.
Other questions? Senator Frank?
Yeah, Laura, can you review the sentencing procedure in the judiciary version? Am I correct that if the jury makes the decision, and then there is a review by the judge?
Through the chair, Senator Frank, the sentencing, and again, I just got the CS today, this morning, so I haven't gone through it word by word to see if there's any other changes that have been made in it. It appears to me that the procedure set out in Article 2 for imposition of sentence is the same in the judiciary CS and the finance, proposed finance CS, and I could be wrong about that because I haven't read it. What's different is if you go to page 8 of the Judiciary CS, at the very bottom of the page, line 29, there's an Article 3 on sentence review that provides for a automatic review by the Supreme Court of a death penalty that's been imposed. That has been deleted entirely from the Finance Committee, proposed Finance Committee CS.
Okay. What does that review consist of in the judiciary version, in your opinion? How does that work?
Through the chair.
Senator Fisher? Sorry? Senator Frank?
Yes.
Yes, I asked Lori a question.
Lori?
Okay, Mr. Chairman. Senator Frank, under current law, anybody can appeal a sentence that's been imposed on them, but they have to file notice of appeal within a certain period of time, and they have to go through certain procedural hoops. what happens, I assume that the reason that an automatic sentence review provision was put in to the death penalty is to make sure that these would all get appealed in a timely manner, that anybody who was sentenced to death would not be precluded from raising a challenge to the death sentence based on filing notice of appeal after 31 days rather than after 30 days. So it sets up protections for people who have been the subject of a death sentence. And then if you go to page 9, subsection C, it sets out, which is on page 9, line 18, you can see that it says that this that doesn't have to, you know, you get rid of the technical requirement to filing a notice of appeal, you don't require a fee, that the record automatically gets transcribed, that you don't have to have the defendant designating what gets transcribed and what doesn't. It's a additional protection for the defendant, plus it speeds up the process so that you don't have somebody not appealing within 30 days but then coming back after a year and a half and raising a collateral attack to their death sentence.
Any other questions for Lori? Thank you. Is there anybody else here that wants to testify from the department? Okay, we're going to take it at ease for a second. Interruption there. Senator Fisher?
Mr. Chairman, what I would do is rescind the motion, or rather, rescind the motion to adopt the committee statute of finance.
Okay, Senator Fisher, will you make a motion?
Yes, I should.
Is there objection to rescinding the motion and adoption of the Finance Committee substitute? It has been rescinded. Senator Fisher?
Okay, if you'll let me for
that's correct. Committee substitute for Senate Bill Number 17, Judiciary.
Okay,
Senator, there is an objection. Senator Bink.
Just briefly, Mr. Chairman, I just thought we could just quickly take a look at the fiscal notes. I haven't had a chance to actually take a look at it. Give me just a moment.
Hefty.
This is, these are the new fiscal notes here.
We shouldn't have some new fiscal notes on the bill.
There are some new fiscal notes, but there's two sets. There's one that was late last night. It wasn't signed, and then a bunch of new ones we got this morning that are signed. And both in there because of the time.
These are the two.
Check the difference between those two fiscal notes.
There should be a public act.
Oh, yes. We have three fiscal notes then. One is from the Public Defender Agency, one from Public Advocacy, and one from the Department of Law.
Correction, Mr. Chairman. I wonder if 300,000 corrections, which. Chair, we have one there, if I may, the Office of Public Advocacy, Public Defender Agency, Department of Law, National Court System, Department of Court of Corrections, and the Division of Elections.
It's in the court system, I don't know where it's at.
Alaska Court System. There's also one from the Alaska court system,
okay. But
it looked like it was last year, so let me just... Is the court...
It's stated 3890.
Oh, 3890. Senator Fisher, what is the cost on all these fiscal notes?
In
what's the total?
5-year projections. I don't know how reliable any of them. Mr. Chairman, just for example, if you compare corrections last year, their 5-year projection was around almost $9 million for 5 years. It's now $300,000. So it's a big change. You don't have to build a $2.5 million facility. They feel $300,000 will do it. So I don't know how you figure any of these things to be as reliable. I think that's probably a fair estimate for that one. And you can take each one, you know, they go out for 5 years, and the high. If you start looking at public advocacy, for example, in 92 was $782,000 to the high of $894,000 in the day of the 5th year. So, whether or not these things happen. I would suspect if you're against the death penalty, you're going to be in a high position. If you're for it, it may have a tendency to do it once, but it's a little bit lower.
Do you think these fiscal notes are too high?
Chairman, for me, I can't determine one way or the other. If you just ask my personal opinion, I think they are high, but in my vote, it's a second guess.
Chairman, it looks like FY91 is only about $2,200, the Department of Elections fiscal note, and then FY92, it's about $4.3 million. But there's been an increase from last year's fiscal notes, I assume. Has there not been?
Some went up and some went down. Is that so?
Some went up, some went down.
The total amount of the fiscal notes are $4,307,000.
For FY92, I believe. Public defender is 410. It's 410. Did I miss that? Oh, you're right. I looked at FY93 for public defenders. Yeah. FY93, it goes up to
Does everybody have their fiscal notes in their packet so that they know what we're looking at here? Senator Frank, Senator Pierce?
27.
Nothing to make a mistake, then. It's $1 million.
Senator Bankley?
Yeah, I think Senator Fisher's right. It's about 2.7 million instead of 4.3. Yeah.
Any questions on the fiscal notes? Any objections? No objections, so ordered. The bill moves out. Next bill on the calendar is Senate Bill 427, Senator Rohde.